Welcome to PharmaTalk Radio. I'm Valerie Bowling, producer at PharmaTalk. The Biotech Chief Medical Officer Summit was delighted to welcome Dr. Michael Rosenblatt, CMO, Flagship Pioneering, as the 2017 keynote. He spoke on lessons learned from the journey of a CMO leader, and we are happy to share this session with you. The 2018 CMO Summit will be held on May 7th and 8th in Boston, where they are gathering the largest group of biotech CMOs to work through the unique issues associated with the mix of R&D and business with limited resources. For more information, visit theconferenceforum.org and be sure to use code TEML for a 10% discount. If you are interested in hearing more podcasts, send your request to service@tcflc.org and you will receive a link. Enjoy the podcast.
It's a great pleasure to be here to have a chat with Mike, who many of you will know. I think without too much exaggeration, it's fair to say that Mike is a legend in the industry. He also is a true gentleman and scholar and has had a remarkable career. We wanted this to be a fun and hopefully informative and interesting discussion. We're going to be very relaxed in the discussion. We'll talk for about 30 years about what Mike has done in his very, very interesting career. I won't say too much by way of introduction, other than, as you know, Mike was at Merck in two periods in his life as the CMO, ultimately, but including in periods where Merck, interesting given the comment that was just made, was the world's most admired company, and was most admired company primarily because it was doing amazing things to help patients. So we'll have a bit of a discussion around that. And then Mike's been very involved in leadership positions at Harvard Medical School, at Beth Israel, and most recently has joined Flagship, where we're also very involved, really looking at next wave, innovative, pioneering biotech type situations. So as I said, we'll keep this fun. And hopefully interesting and informative, and we'll allow for 10 minutes or so at the end. So just to kick things off, mate, I think be a good start from the beginning in terms of the beginning of your life and your career in medicine and so on, and I think be useful just to give a bit of perspective as to how you got into the medical world and the beginning of your career, and I think also your journey to starting at Merck, which I personally... Also, for everyone else's background, I think everybody has probably some idea of Merck's history and its glory days on the medical side, but it was very interesting how they chose who they should bring into Merck to lead fundamental research and development.
Well, thanks, Suma. First of all, I'm very pleased you're interviewing me. I can relax. We've worked together now in Flagship and Velo, so I thank you for that. And I'll also comment that I think it's really great that the CMOs get together like this and share some issues in common. I'm sure you can all help each other out and maybe in tough times huddle together for warmth. I grew up in an immigrant family, which I think has a lot to do with where I've wound up. There was a kind of drive to take advantage of the opportunities that this great country affords people. And I did not start out heading towards medical school. Actually, nobody in my family, because of the immigrant circumstances, had ever gone to college, let alone medical school. I was the first one. And that, I think, had two elements that influenced me a lot. One, it was a family that was very supportive and valued education a lot. But since there weren't any role models, I got, in a way, to invent myself and follow what I was interested in. And I headed off to college thinking I would be a chemist, and then encountered some humanities courses and rethought that, thought that, you know, medicine might be a way to combine both the humanities and my interest in science. The other thing that happened in college was I had the opportunity to do some research. And I really got the bug for research, thought that I could be a physician scientist. And those two threads, the kind of humanism part and the research, which I'm a deep believer in research, and I've seen the things it can do in the world to transform disease and promote health, kind of set the stage for my going to medical school. At first I thought that I would probably return to New Jersey where I grew up and be a practicing doctor.
Yes.
And then because of the opportunities in research, I thought I would stay in academic medicine. Early on, I got a chance to have a leadership role at the Mass General to head endocrinology. I might comment, Simba, I think we don't, when I look back and see that people took a chance on me when I was very young.
How old were you?
I was 33 when I became the head of the endocrine division at Mass General. I don't see us doing that very often now. Maybe in the small companies, but you know, in the big companies or in the academic medical centers, I don't see that as much. And I think we're losing a chance to develop really talented people, and certainly some really talented people don't get the chances that I got.
Can I just jump in, Mike?
Sure, please.
You said a couple
anytime.
Of things. Yeah. Actually, I just want a quick show of hands on a couple of points. How many people in the room are immigrants? Put your hands up. Interesting. And how many of you are under 40? Okay, so it's about, I'd say, about 30, 40% immigrants, and about, interestingly to your point, 10-ish percent under 40.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I'll let you keep going as you flow. We'll come back to those two themes because I think they're kind of interesting themes.
So I remember when I got that first post, I came home and said to my wife, well, I think we can unpack. I've got my dream job, and I'm going to be here. Mm-hmm. Hopefully we'll be here forever. And then I started consulting to Merck, and I got really intrigued with the programs there that I was consulting to, and I noticed that all the things I was writing in my grant applications about my research will point the way to new drugs, they were actually doing it. I was just writing it. And so Roy Vagelos was the head of Merck Research at the time, and they had an opening to head about a third of Merck Research. And he approached me, and I would say of all the career decisions that I've made along the way, and I've kind of changed and done different things in 5 to 10 year periods, that was the biggest and the most liberating one, because I thought I was on this academic medical track, and then when I saw something that really interested me, first I recognized it, and second, I was willing to take a chance and do it. Wasn't, in retrospect, it wasn't a big chance, but in the world I was in, it seemed like a big chance. And the other thing, sort of back to family, was unlike a lot of my colleagues in academic medicine who had a lot of biases against industry, in the home that I grew up in, which were small business people, I didn't have a bias against commerce or industry, and I thought the problems that my mom was a businesswoman that she was talking about were pretty interesting to me. So when the opportunity came along, I was willing to make a big career shift, and that single decision actually liberated me to think about many different things in that career. You asked about what kind of leaders Merck was looking for then.
Yeah.
You know, Roy Vagelos was the head of research. He soon became the CEO. There was a real value on having physician scientists in the mix. Mm-hmm. And about half of the top leaders of research were physician scientists. And they were all people who did research, but they all understood at least one therapeutic area. And they brought with them not only the insights that a physician has about research, but the kind of values towards patients and, you know, how could we help them, what was worth doing, what wasn't worth doing.
Yeah. So I think we're spending a few moments on that period of your career and lessons learned. We can sort of jump to some other lessons that you might have got. So everybody, again, presumably knows the history of Merck in the relevant period. It was absolutely seen as the most admired company in the world across all industries, was phenomenally productive. And what's intriguing to me, so I spent most of my career working for biotech companies. I did my stint in Big Pharma. But with due apologies to any of you who work in Big Pharma right now, I think we're in a pretty tragic world right now where Big Pharma is highly unproductive. And what's always been interesting to me is, what was there something special that Roy Vagelos saw in building the leadership team and the philosophy, particularly from the context of, to your point on scientific and clinical-driven medical people, whether it's in the CMO role or more broadly? Because it seems, so could have been lucky. Interestingly, he's been very involved in some other big successes, including Regeneron. Pretty remarkable story. So were the things that were being done then that were differentiated from the general situation, and thoughts on lessons there, particularly obviously in the context of, given we're full of CMOs, lessons for CMOs and the importance of good clinical, maybe clinical research-based medicine?
Well, yeah, I think there was a tremendous emphasis on the quality of science and understanding where science could go. So when I joined, we were, I would say, on the tail end of chemistry really running Big Pharma, that you didn't often have molecular targets. There was a lot of screening, and it was great chemistry that made the history of the company. And I think what Roy did was to really shift to molecular targets. And that was a giant move. And then, as we all know, in the world of science is fundamental to medicine, things happened very quickly. Then molecular biology and recombinant DNA and all that. The big companies weren't necessarily as fast as others to pick up on it, but they did eventually pick up on it. So I think bringing biology in and pathophysiology was really the big thing. But I do want to return to the patient part of it, because while I was there with all of the the great productivity and success, that was also the time when Roy led the group into making this huge decision to give away Mectizam for river blindness around the world. And nothing like that had ever been done before. I was on the research committee that, voted to do that. Roy went to the board and said, we found out we have something that can help people, and these people can't afford to buy medicine that'll prevent them from becoming blind. And the board said, what do you want to do? And he said, I want to give it away. And they said, for how long? Until the disease is cured? And what are you going to do the next time something like this accidentally gets discovered in the lab? And Roy said, we'll give it away again. Mm. So that was a special kind of leadership.
So I think there's an interesting topic there, again, in a room full of CMOs. So Merck still has a credo that you put the patients first before everything else. I was telling Mike earlier today, I was on another panel at Harvard Medical School not very long ago, and it was advising clinicians at Harvard who want to go into the commercial world, meaning the biotech or pharma world, to start companies, move things forward, how they should go about it. And one of my panel members led with, you need to first of all recognize that money comes first and the patient comes second. And he talked eloquently about that. Obviously, in the last 20, 30 years, there are actually huge amounts of money that can be made in a way which actually wasn't possible before in biotech. Interesting, following on from a rare disease company session. So that started because rare disease patients had nobody. It's become one of the most popular areas in biotech, not because of that, but because people make huge amounts of money in it. So thoughts on just actually at a personal level and any, again, advice. I raise this because as someone who's been in the industry for 30 years, increasingly what I feel is whether it's clinicians or others, people are doing what they're doing for money and more than they maybe used to. I don't know what your perspective there is.
Well, I guess I believe in that old George Merck quote about medicine's not for the profits and it's for the people and the patients, and if you focus on them, things will take care of themselves. And that's pretty much, maybe I've been sheltered, but that's the way I've been able to have my career in medicine and medical research. And you know, even jumping ahead a little now, I'm in the world of creating biotech companies now. And so we have to make decisions about which companies to start and how much money we're going to put in, or when they reach a certain level, do we fund again? We never have discussions about the money and how much money it might return. We have discussions about value.
Yep.
Will the discoveries, will the inventions be of value to people, but rarely quantitated? Clearly you have to do some of that, but I don't think that's the engine of the place. That may be a little governor that steers it right or steers it left, but it's not the engine in my experience.
Yeah, for what it's worth, I agree with that completely. Yeah. So back on the Merck, early part of your Merck history before we move on to the next phase of your career, Mike. So just in terms of the success that Merck had there, and again, I'm thinking about lessons for a CMO audience, was Merck doing something fundamentally different? Because the industry as a whole, particularly the large pharma companies today, have, you know, what I think one would hesitate to call anything but a disastrous track record in terms of productivity in the modern world. So do you think Merck was doing something different?
I don't know if there was a secret sauce. I know there was a huge emphasis on bringing in talent, talent that was able to take advantage of the most modern science. And they had the reputation. So, you know, if you bring in a few good people, or there are a few good people, in key positions, they can attract others. And I remember when my father-in-law was a chemist. And so when I got my first faculty position at Harvard, he was, you know, he was very proud of his son-in-law got this position. And, you know, then when I took a position at Merck, he was like, wow, this guy is really... So it was really interesting. It was because of the reputation of the place. And I wouldn't have gone if it didn't have that reputation. Mm-hmm. But there were others around. So I think, you know, who you run with is really important. And they were people who challenged each other and your ambitions, you know. So our ambition wasn't to make money. Our ambition was to change the world in as many diseases as we could. And, you know, we're fortunate it played out positively in some of those areas. But I think that's what it is. It's talent and ambitions and really good science.
It's all really good points. And I think maybe moving on to next phase of your career. So obviously, Merck, you were there during a great period. I think one of the things that I always think a lot about is that within our industry, actually, failure, meaning the drugs that you're working on or the projects you're working on or the life that you're in from a business perspective, is the more typical situation. It's very unusual in that context. And so I think a lot of interesting potential lessons from when you moved to being in charge of Beth Israel and your experience coming back into this world and leaving Merck. So I think it's useful to talk about that a little bit.
Well, yeah, a couple of things. I think, you know, failure is an opportunity to learn from it. One of the things I did as a CMO when I was to borrow medical teaching vehicle of starting morbidity and mortality rounds. You know, why did this drug die? What can we learn from it? There, you know, organizations go through various lifespans. When I was the president of the Beth Israel, there was a huge learning curve because the hospital was, it was a distressed organization at the time. We were kind of on the verge of going belly up. People in an organization operate very differently when they're worried about whether the organization is going to go under. And I think it's another time when you have to kind of go to your inner core, your values, or, you know, some people talk about a North Star. I mean, you need, when things are really stressed and stuff is flying around you,
yeah,
that's the time, I think, when you have to find that in you. And, of course, the temptation is to do what we do in many companies. You know, you pivot. This thing didn't go well.
Yep.
We pivot. We go that way. We go that way. But you can't do that with your values or your integrity. And things don't always work out the way you want them to. But even if they don't, you're at least able then to move on. If things don't work out well and you haven't maintained your integrity, you're in real trouble at the end of that phase.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. And interesting that you made that decision to go to a situation like the Beth Israel situation and so on. So what was your... So I think, again, it's probably interesting for people, given the career path you led. You didn't lead a classic... You know, nowadays, I think there's a sort of relatively classic path where people will leave academia, go into a biotech or a pharma company and work their way up, et cetera. And you bounced around a little bit. And
yeah. Yeah,
benefit, value of that, is that something you'd advise people to consider? Or,
well... Simba, I'm an endocrinologist, which
yep.
means that I've got receptors. So I'm always like displaying receptors and seeing what...
Yep.
So my advice is to like display receptors and see what, mm-hmm. you know, what gets bound to, what gets tickled. And so I think you can do things in sequence. It's hard to do more than one job at once and do it well, but hopefully life is long and you have a chance to do some things. I would have, I never dreamed that I was going to be running a hospital, and I didn't return to Boston to do that. I actually returned to run a program to train physician scientists that was a Harvard-MIT program, but one of my medical school classmates and very good friends became the head of that hospital system. And they knew that in changing times, they had to make some big adjustments. And so I got asked to do that. And I felt strongly about the mission mm-hmm. of the place. And so I was willing to take a chance. It was, things eventually worked out well. It was not my first choice of what I would work on. But I learned a ton in many ways. The other institutions I'd been at, Merck and Harvard, they had more money than God. Mm. And you could get through these challenging situations.
Yep.
But the experience of being in a place that's financially stressed, I learned a lot about management there.
Yeah. Yeah. So just so everyone's clear, I'm CEO of a biotech company. I've had CEO and president positions in biotech for a long time now. And so I often have to recruit CMOs or equivalent, and I also have a hat as an investor, which I've also had for many, many years now. And so what that leads to is, you know, my hat as an investor or as a CEO, depending on the circumstance, one has general views as to what one's looking for in a CMO. And it's interesting because the starting point that people normally go to is you want someone who's experienced. Actually, typically, people think about someone who's experienced in phase 3 or even phase 4 studies. And you just picked up on two things, actually. What I tend to look for is people who know how to lead and how to manage through difficulty. It's bucket one. And the second is people who can understand the point you raised earlier, science as it relates to clinical medicine. And actually, the other thing most people normally look for is execution ability, but actually, hopefully you've all got execution ability, otherwise you shouldn't be in the room. But the thing that is differential, or the things that are differential, is the ability to lead and manage in difficult times and the ability to connect clinical science, clinical medicine to science. Is, you know, personally where I see the differentiation. And then being resilient through the difficult times, absolutely, I think that's huge.
You know, the chief medical officer position, hopefully people are in companies where everyone shares the same values about the importance of patients, and that will guide you through these stressful times. But sometimes it actually just falls on the chief medical officer in a way to provide some moral compass to the organization when it could be pulled apart. So I think that's another factor. The experience part, I think some of it has to do with doing clinical trials and understanding how to do them. But the other thing is, you know, people who have been through some kind of crucible, you can predict how they're going to behave under the most stressful circumstances. Other people who haven't, you know, they're very good people, and they may operate, may function really well, but they might not. You won't know. So some of the things that I look for when I'm trying to hire someone for a high-level experience, high-level position is, what have they actually been through?
Yeah.
And can they tell me what they learned through that?
Yeah. That's an interesting point, because actually a lot of people in that context look for people who have been continuously successful, which normally means they've been very lucky. you need to assign people who've been successful and been through difficult times. That's interesting. So a couple of other, I think, core topics, and then I wanted to allow time for questions. So two other things we can maybe talk about. So going back to Merck and being the CMO of the great Merck, in a period where Merck, arguably together with BMS, have really changed the whole face of clinical oncology and the impact that that sort of had, and how strategically and otherwise in that role as CMO at Merck, how that sort of evolved, I think is an interesting topic. And just thoughts of actually the impact of medicine broadly in the world in times like that, or you probably had experiences in other areas. I think that's one thing we should talk about. And then I want to make sure we have time to talk about your experience at Flagship, because that's yet another aspect of what you've done in your life that's very interesting.
Well,
and different.
I think everyone in the room knows that that immune oncology has transformed a number of cancers, transformed the way we think about the approach to certain kinds of cancers, and it's been... It just confirms my faith in research, which I've seen since I was a boy in the polio epidemic, and then when I ran a hospital that was had a quarter of the beds filled with people with AIDS, who were, that was a universal death sentence, worse than cancer. Now it's a chronic disease people live with. We've seen hepatitis C, and on and on. I think for me, the one of the things that... that the immune oncology drug taught me was kind of how to move a big organization to doing something that's in its mission, but not always easy to do. So I was there when we looked at the first set of data on pembrolizumab, Keytruda, in malignant melanoma. And I'd never seen, as a physician, I'd never seen anything like that. People who should have been dead about 6 months were kept going. And remarkable remissions, possibly cures. I don't think we know that. And, you know, as soon as I saw that data, I realized that as fast as the FDA might work, that drug wasn't going to get approved for another 6, 9, maybe even 12 months, and that the people currently living with metastatic melanoma who had failed all other therapies weren't going to be around for that approval. And so I initiated the compassionate use program, And, you know, even at a place like Merck, where I think the values are very good, you know, there are issues about supplies or people don't have the bandwidth because they're running the clinical trials, or will it impact the regulatory decisions? And I just said, you know, this is Merck, and we have to do this. And we got the drug to 6,000 people before approval in the United States. And I'm sure many lives were saved as a result. So even, you know, even in the midst of a huge breakthrough or something, there's still work, work to be done. And that was a great experience. So.
And obviously, Merck took a very different approach to BMS in terms of patient stratification. So thoughts on that, which is a general comment. So obviously, you know, BMS basically went with a strategy of we're going to make it the drug approved on the basis of going after all patients and ran their clinical studies in that basis, where you had a much more sophisticated biomarker-driven patient stratification approach. So,
well, from the beginning, we were trying to do what we thought would be practicing the best medicine. Mm-hmm. So you have an expensive drug, a drug that potentially had toxicity, and the idea was to try to get it to the people most likely to respond. The biomarkers are imperfect, so it was a bit of a bet. We got punished originally by the financial community for self-limiting the potential sales, but that's the direction we thought medicine was going in, and that precision would come eventually, and we may as well be on the leading edge of that. And that turned out to be a good decision. It was a gamble, but it was a good decision.
Yep. With my financial hat on, I'm not sure how closely all of you follow the situation, but it's interesting. So BMS has lost somewhere between $10 and $15 billion in the last not too distant past. Actually, interesting, as a result of their approach, equally they gained $20 billion before from that approach. So it's fascinating how that evolves. So I do want to make sure we talk about your newest phase, which is again a complete shift from everything else we've talked about. So joining Flagship, and in full disclosure, I'm very associated with Flagship. I'm a senior partner there, and I'm CEO of one of their companies. So we probably have similar reasons for joining Flagship, etc., Mike, but big shift again from everything you've done. And actually, just by way of background, Flagship's, for those of you who don't know, leading investor in early-stage platform-driven science innovation. So companies like Moderna, which is pioneering messenger RNA therapy, et cetera, that type of approach. But thoughts as to, again, why you did that, and how does that compare experientially with obviously running a major hospital, being a professor, being at Merck as a CMO of Merck?
Well, I am really enjoying myself now. I don't have my hands on the steering wheel of anything, which is... which I was ready for. I wanted to find something where I could be contributing but still be learning. And because Flagship pretty much invests in platforms, so you don't know what therapeutic... Sometimes we start companies, we don't know what therapeutic area it's going to be. And there's a lot of room to... bring some know-how and medical insights, go into this field, stay away from that field. And they have their own laboratories. So we're actually creating these companies. And for me, it's I'm learning a new way of thinking, because we had all of my research career, you kind of move to the boundary, and if you can make a drug by the leading edge of science, you change the boundary. But it's always in a field, oncology or rheumatology. Yep. Here we're just going out with the technology and we're trying to find our way back to a field. And the other thing I would say is, in these big organizations, and we need them, and I have a lot of admiration for them, you're spending a lot of your time on all the things that make the organization work, you know. And maybe, if you're lucky, 20% of your time on creative thinking.
Yeah.
And in a place like Flagship, it's the opposite. Yep. You know, 80% creative, and you do have to spend some time making the organization work.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. And I should link to that as well. I'm, as you know, Mike, I'm sort of relatively recent to Boston. I moved here 2 years ago. But thoughts on actually Boston and the greater Boston,
well,
Cambridge
aren't,
world?
Aren't we lucky, those of us who are here? This is, I think, for someone who's in the sciences, the life sciences fundamental to medicine, this is not only an unbelievable moment in the evolution of science when so much can be translated. I mean, there's a reason there are a few hundred biotech companies within a stone's throw of here. But it's the moment in science, and it's this particular geography right now that has just come into its own. So I feel very lucky that I'm in medicine and science and on this spot in the planet at this particular moment.
Yep. Yeah. Couldn't agree more with that. So maybe nice stepping off point for a few questions. So,
well, you're lucky you won't be here when it's all underwater.
Yeah. You're right.
That's exactly. So I think we've got time for a few questions from the audience on anything, I think.
They're all easy. Just, were you at Merck when the Vioxx thing started to unravel? First question.
No.
Okay. What do you think the biggest learnings were? I was at FDA when it did, as I said. So what do you think the biggest learnings were? This is my second question. So even though you weren't there, what was the biggest learning, you think, or that we can kind of drink now about that whole issue? And what might they do differently going forward? When something like that happens, you know, it was the big Merck and Pfizer fight and the drugs going down the tubes. You weren't there, but I'm sure you observed it like we all did, and I certainly did as an insider at the agency. But I just wonder, what was your opinion about what went wrong and what could they do different by today's standards?
So, you know, I wasn't there during the discussions, and, you know, arguably one of the reasons that the position of a chief medical officer was created for the first time at Merck was that there wasn't a physician in the executive committee to participate in the decisions around Vioxx. You know, from what I've heard really secondhand, and my own sense of it is that Merck made a decision based on side effects, cardiovascular side effects, that were in the studies, which, by the way, we now know is in every drug in that class, but at the time they didn't. So what I heard was that they had a belief, they voluntarily took it off the market. As you know, FDA did not take the drug off the market. They made the decision voluntarily to take it off. They felt, they anticipated that the world was going to applaud their decision, and that they would be held up as heroes for doing it. And instead, you know, the first, what did you know? When did you know it? How many people have been affected? And the whole thing really went downhill after that. So I think there, this is unfair, and in retrospect, for me, the decision is getting back to the patient and benefit risk. And that probably what the company should have done, and maybe with some guidance from the FDA, is to say, look, there's a finding here that's real or probably real, and we ought to let the patient and the doctor with the patient have best information possible, information you can trust because the FDA has put its imprimatur on it, and give them a black box or whatever, but let them make the decision, not take away something that was really helping a lot of people, that risk was discovered, people make that decision about benefit risk and don't get too paternalistic about it.
Yeah, great question. Thank Did you have a third question? I got two.
No, that was it. I prescribed that drug hundreds of times as a GP.
Yeah.
Same in that respect. Yeah. It was unfortunate, and for me, I was a junior guy at the time.
Yeah.
It was a big learning for me.
Yeah.
Watching that political sideshow.
Yeah.
On the inside, right? I didn't know anything, but I'm watching it, feeling it, and thinking some of it feels right and some of it doesn't. But I just didn't know what I didn't know.
It changed the whole industry.
It definitely changed the whole industry.
Yeah.
Please.
Okay. Thank you. Just a quick comment. My understanding with Vioxx was that. Originally, it was approved for menstrual cramp pain relief, and it worked very well for that. That's what I thought. But and then my understanding also is that they tried a new indication at a much higher dose, and that's when they found the problem. So I think part of it was driven by greed, to look for a bigger market, right, to compete against Celebrex. But that's what I've been told. And that was what I was told by people at Merck Frost. So this is my comment about large pharma. It's too bad that their answer is to build new buildings and move people and close major sites, because I think what that does is it limits the amount of trust that they'll get from their people, because is they built, like for Pfizer builds a new building, Bristol-Myers builds a new building. For every building they're building, they're tearing down two, right? So I agree with the limitations on the market, but they're really good people and they have a lot of experience, but I think they hurt themselves by doing that.
Yeah, back to your first view, I don't know. I hadn't heard that, in all honesty. I know the intention. From the very beginning, they had COX-2 inhibitors. They thought that this would work like the NSAIDs, but not have any of the GI side effects because of the biology. So I think they were thinking about a lot of different anti-inflammatory pain relief indications from the very beginning. Menstrual pain would be a good one because of the particular pathophysiology. But I don't think they had a narrow to begin with. And, I agree with you that there should be ways to renew a place without necessarily closing sites. It's in a way the same kind of thing is happening with biotech companies, but it's the whole company closes and a new one opens. Someplace else, I haven't been part of those decisions. I think it's very hard on people. Fortunately, at this particular era, the biotech sector is doing so well that most of those people are able to find something else, but not everybody. So I understand your concern.
So I think we're out of time and over, so we should wrap up that. Just to emphasize, just link to all of this, actually. So I think one of the unusual things about our industry in general, but particularly in the medical role, the chief medical role, is that by definition, you're fundamentally always challenged with conflicting things. So businesses are set up to make lots of money. That's what they're meant to be doing. Clinicians and the industry is trying to save people's lives and improve the quality of people's lives, including actually its employees. And those things are just in fundamental conflict. And I actually do think you mentioned it, Mike. I think having integrity, and I think it's actually part of the CMO's role, or can be, is actually ensuring that there is a bit of a moral compass within an organization, because these are difficult decisions and there's always trade-offs around them. So always a pleasure, Mike, and thank you very much.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast. The 2018 CMO Summit will be held on May 7th and 8th in Boston. For more information, visit theconferenceforum.org and be sure to use code TEML for 10% discount. If you are interested in hearing more podcasts, send your request to service@tcfllc.org and you will receive a link. Thank you.